always love you. But long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, though life would still go on, believe me, the world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Wanted to read a statement that Jordan Maxwell has sent us. You might remember the night of April 19th on our program, right at the end, he just merely disappeared. He was cut off. Something happened to his phone right in the closing moments. Well, let me read this. Since then, I've been the recipient of several different forms of harassment and electronic attack. The night of the radio show, I received threatening phone calls after the show ended. A few days later, my email list system was broken into, apparently for the purpose of destroying my credibility by sending hundreds of emails to people all over the world. In addition, someone has been sending out mass emails purporting to be from me by using various phony free email accounts that are not in any way associated with me. For example, jordanmaxwell@earthling.net. That is not my email address, nor are any of the several others that are being used to steal my identity. My only real email address is the one prominently displayed on my website. I do not use any other. I ask everyone that may have received emails related to these incidents to please delete those messages. Do not reply to them or forward them on. I have posted an accounting of everything that has been going on my website. Please read the information on the front page of my website, jordanmaxwell.com, for a full explanation. Thank you for your support and understanding. That's from our guest, Jordan Maxwell. Now, there aren't many best-selling authors that would write in their book, "Be careful, this book is dangerous." In a moment, Neil Donald Walsh on Coast to Coast AM. And for those of you already calling, not yet, later on tonight, we'll open up the phone line so you can talk with Neil. But hold on. Neil Donald Walsh is a modern-day spiritual messenger whose words continue to touch the world in very profound ways. Following high school, he enrolled at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee, but academic life could not hold his interest, and he dropped out of college after 2 years to follow an interest in radio broadcasting. He then became a radio station program director, a newspaper reporter, and ultimately managing editor, and then public information officer for one of the nation's largest public school systems. After moving to the West Coast, he became creator and owner of his own public relations and marketing firm. He then moved to Oregon and became a syndicated radio talk show host. Neil is the author of the renowned With God series, and with the help of his wife, Nancy Fleming Walsh, created the Conversations with God Foundation. He is our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Neil, it's been way too long. It's good to have you back.
Hello, George. How have you been?
Good. I'm doing fine. And you, as usual, continue to, enlighten us with your writings, Neil.
That's a very kind thing to say. I've always hoped that something that I may have done would bring some benefit to a few people, and it seems to have done that, so I feel very fulfilled in that, but I don't feel real arrogant about it or boastful around it, because one can never know. You know, someone asked me the other day, do you ever worry about, you know, whether what you've written has any accuracy? Do you ever think about that maybe you might be deluding yourself? And of course I do. We write a book called Conversations with God. The only answer I could give that person is, the day that I stop worrying about stuff like that, the day that I stop doubting, is the day that I become dangerous.
That's true. I remember when we talked in November 2002. You told me, and it was the very first time I had an opportunity to chat with you, about this incredible story of how this all started for you, how it all began. For those many new listeners, Neil, who are familiar with your writings, but maybe not with this particular story, would you tell us again what happened? Because those were some dark times for you.
Well, yes, I had reached really the nadir of my existence. It was the worst time of my life. I had an automobile accident, George, in which I broke my neck. And I was very, very lucky, extraordinarily lucky, to get out alive. It was one of those matters that you hear about, a matter of inches and seconds. And I was walking around with a broken neck without knowing it, in a lot of pain but not knowing why, for about a week and a half. And then because the, as life would have it and luck would have it, the radiologist was a new kid who was really an intern, and he misread the x-rays the night of my accident and missed the fact that I had a 3/4-inch fracture of my neck. And I was going to a chiropractor to get an adjustment because my neck didn't feel right. And on the way to the chiropractor's office, the phone rang, and I was in the chiropractor's, in the building where the chiropractor was, and the phone rang. I had left the number there for my wife and others to know where I was, and they caught me there. The doctor caught me there, and he said, "Don't go into that office.
Don't let him touch your neck.
Don't let him touch your neck, or you won't come out of there alive. You have a broken neck." And it was just, I was scheduled to go in 5 minutes later. So it was just one of those moments in life that changes everything. But what happened then in my life is that I lost my job. I was out of work. I was on the streets, living on the street, a few months after the incident that I'm just now telling you about, wearing a Philadelphia collar that I had to wear for the next 18 months, going to physical therapy every day of my life, but having very little money. The insurance of course, the guy that hit me in the car was in the wrong, but I didn't see, as happens often in claims like this, didn't see the insurance money for about 3 years later, when I didn't need it anymore, frankly.
Yeah,
it was way,
exactly.
way past that. So there I was, living on the street, outside in a tent for the better part of a year, panhandling for money, trying to stay alive because I fell through the cracks of the system of assistance in this country. And then, as luck would have it, I picked up a newspaper in the trash. I was dumpster diving. I would get a lot of food out of the trash and other good things and roadkill. And I was a street person of the highest rank. I'd been out there about 9 or 10 months at that point and learned how to survive. And there was an ad in the classifieds. I was grabbing newspapers to put on the bottom of my tent as a floor to keep the tent from leaking and some seeping moisture in from the ground. So there was an ad that said weekend radio fill-in announcer, and you know, they're in Medford, Oregon, of all places. And I thought, how many people can there be in Medford, Oregon, who have any broadcast experience, who are hanging around not already working?
Right.
So I panhandled a quarter from someone and went to the nearest phone booth and called the radio station and asked if I could speak to the program director. He wasn't in, of course. That would have been too easy. So she said, "Can he call you back?" And I'm giving him the number here at this phone booth, thinking when this guy calls back, there's going to be no question about a semi driving right by this phone booth, and I'm going to have to explain to this guy why there's a semi going through my living room, because I don't want him, of course, to know that I'm calling from a phone booth outside, that I'm living on the street. Anyway, long story short, I got the job. I wound up pulling myself out of that. I eventually got off the street, got a little apartment, found a lady, and got back into real life. Within 6 months, I was working again full-time in broadcasting, doing my thing, and that's when I realized the vacuous life that I was living, because I had gotten out of the worst space of my life, the nadir of my existence,
right.
And things were, no, I was right back into the rat race. And there's only one problem with the rat race, George, that is that even if you win, you're still a rat.
That's true.
So there I was, and that's when I woke up and realized, oh, my God, I'm right back where I was before. Nothing is going to change. Get me out of here. This doesn't make any sense to me. My life is not working. My career had reached a dead end in the sense that here I was in Medford, Oregon, at a 250-watt radio station, and I was, you know, better than that. And I was 50 years old. My relationship with this new lady was going downhill rapidly, and my health was going downhill as well. And that's when I woke up in the middle of the night. night, one night, and I said to myself, hey, you know what, you're 50 years old. There's got to be something other than this going on. I don't. What's the point? What is it? What is it that I don't know, the knowing of which would change everything? And I walked out into the darkness of the night in my home, sat on the couch by the moonlight. I saw a yellow pad, yellow legal pad, sitting on the table in front of me, and I picked it up and I began writing a very, very angry letter to the universe. And I recall the first words that I wrote: what does it take to make life work? What have I done to deserve a life of such continuing struggle? And somebody tell me the rules. Just give me the rule book. I'll play. Just tell me the rules and don't change them once you tell them to me. And there I was writing that angry letter to the universe, to God, to whatever, to myself. I didn't have any plan.
You just wanted to write.
That's it. Getting it out. Just getting it out. A little form of self-therapy. And I heard a voice over my right shoulder, just as clearly as I'm hearing your voice on this phone tonight, right there over my right shoulder. And the voice simply said, now, mind you, it's 4:20 in the morning. I'd gotten up in the middle of the night to do this writing. Just stomping around the house trying to find wisdom in the middle of the night. And here's this voice at 4:20 in the morning, and it says to me over my right shoulder, very quietly, very softly, but very distinctly, Neil, do you really want answers to all of these questions, or are you just venting? And I damn near jumped out of my skin. I turned around. Of course, there was no one there. And I thought, wow, what an imagination. I just made that up. The voice came back again with the same question. And so I found myself almost automatically, without really thinking about it, writing an answer down. I wasn't going to talk out loud to a disembodied voice that wasn't there. I was shaking. I was scared. I thought I had somehow communicated with another level of consciousness or awareness, if not trafficking with the devil, whatever was going on. So I wrote down on the piece of paper, on the legal pad that I was writing on, you know, what's going on, who is this, and what's happening. And instantly, I was overcome with a sense of a peace, an inner peace.
And were these words just flowing back to you?
Yes, instantly. Instantly, I was made to know, one, everything was fine. Relax, everything is okay. And if you really want answers to these questions, just ask them one by one and I will answer you. And so I began writing down questions that I had for life itself, about life. And as soon as I would finish writing the question, even before I finished writing the question, the entire answer would be like downloaded into my mind, just right there. And it was all I could do to keep up with it and to write as fast as I could to get everything down. And then I would ask the next question, because, of course, what I was given would lead to another question. I would ask a question and get another answer, a question and an answer, until before I knew it, I found myself engaged in an on-paper dialogue, question-answer, that was healing me. And I hate to be this trite. I truly hate to be this hackneyed, but that's exactly what was happening. I was feeling healed and made whole in that moment. And the experience was so complete that I was crying, I mean, weeping. I can remember that I was using a felt-tip pen at the time, and the ink was running because I was weeping on the yellow legal pad.
Oh, sure, yeah.
At how extraordinary this was, and the answers that I received to the questions were changing my life right in that moment, even as they have changed the lives of, now they tell us, around 8 million people who have purchased my book.
Yeah, exactly, and that's conservative. I think there's much more out there that you've touched, because other people have changed. As a matter of fact, Neil, years ago, a friend of mine who just thinks the world of you, Johnny Rose from St. Louis, and he'll probably call in during our chat session with you, brought me your book, your first book, Conversations with God. And he said, you've got to read this. And I did, and I went, my gosh. Actually, I said, my God.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was just so compelling. As you were writing then, was it changing you instantly?
On the spot. Yes, it was an in-the-moment transformation, little by little, but I mean, it wasn't a complete transformation, but little parts of me, first my anger was disappearing, then my resentment would disappear, then my fear would dissipate, then my anxiety went away, and one by one, these little elements of my life that were causing me to be so depressed and so put off by the whole thing and really ready to check out, were being healed. And that was going on for that entire evening, for that entire night. I wrote there for about 4 or 5 hours until 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning. The house started coming alive. It was a Saturday morning. I didn't have to go anywhere. And but as the house became alive, I got out of there. I got out of the living room and went off to someplace private so that I could continue this for a little bit longer, but then it was impossible. So I put it aside until the next night. And the next night I got up again around 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning and began again. And the connection was seamless. I picked up right where I left off. This went on for about 3 months, every single night of my life, until I had hundreds and hundreds of handwritten pages of dialogue. And at that point, I realized that something extraordinary was happening and that it was meant for more than just for me. In fact, in the dialogue, George, it said, "This will one day become a book." I didn't believe that at the time. It was one of many things that I did not fully believe or fully embrace. But I had learned by that time, this was around 3 months into it, not to edit myself. I don't know whether I believe what I was writing, but I did make kind of an agreement with myself that I would just write down whatever was coming to me and not edit myself or stop myself from writing what I was hearing in my head. So I wrote that down there. Yeah, this will one day become a book. Sure, sure. But in fact...
it became more than a book, you know, as you well know, a New York Times bestseller. And to everybody listening here tonight, writing a book when you really don't have a lot of experience as an author, and this was your first one, is not easy because first and foremost, Neil, publishers hardly even look at you. How did this come about? When you were all finished and you read what you had been writing over the months and you decided, all right, I want to get this published. I want other people to share in this. Who did you go to and what was your reaction?
Well, you know, George, I really didn't set it off with that motivation. I wish I could say that I was that elevated. I want other people to share in this and so forth. The truth is, I sent it to publishers to test the veracity of the material. It was really just a test. The book said, this will one day become a book. And my intention was to see whether I had just gone totally nuts or whether there was anything real that was occurring here. So I thought, well, if this book gets published, because I know, as you know, that publishers get 500 manuscripts a week,
exactly,
unsolicited,
yeah.
and they hardly, as you just said, hardly ever even read. They're not even opened, actually. They get sent back with form letters without even half of them being opened up. So I thought, well, you know, it says this will one day become a book. Let's just see. So I kind of stuck my jaw out a little bit and sent it to publishers, not really because I had these high motivations of sharing it with the world. Actually, the truth is I was simply trying to prove the veracity of the material and to see whether I could believe in what was being brought to me and brought through me. So I sent it off to 5 publishers. I just took the manuscript just as it was. I mean, by that time I had gotten a stenographer to keyboard the manuscript in. And by the way, this was not a person that I knew. I just hired somebody out of the want ads who just did some keyboard work.
So you didn't send copies of your handwritten writings then? You had it all typed up?
No, I found some lady who typed it, who keyboarded it in for me, and she called me in the middle of it. I said, I don't know what I've got here, but something strange is happening, but here it is. And I sent her the chapters as I was finished with them at that point, and the process was still ongoing when I asked her to do this work for me. And when I sent her the last chapter, she called me about in the middle of it, and she said, I don't know what this is either, but it's I'm crying. It's changing my life. It's moving me to tears. It's moving me to clarity. Where is this stuff coming from? I said, well, you know, I think we're going to call the book Conversations with God, because that's what it feels like it is to me. And so she finished typing it up, and I wound up having it printed it out and had a limited number of manuscripts made. I think there were 5 or 6 manuscripts, and I sent them off to some publishers whose names I had gotten by going to a local bookstore.
Oh, my God.
And seeing who was publishing books of this sort.
Yeah. Okay.
And of course the publishers' names and addresses are right in the books, so I just turned to the first inside cover and I got the names of 4 or 5 publishers, and Hampton Roads Publishing was one of them. Actually, that particular publisher was the idea to send it there was given to me by my wife Nancy, who said, because I was getting rejection letters from the other 3 or 4, mm-hmm. She said, send it to these guys. And so I sent it to Hampton Roads because they had published a book that Nancy had read by Mary Summerrain. So I sent it off to Hampton Roads, and they rejected it also, by the way. Interesting story there. I got a rejection letter from Hampton Roads, but here's how life works. It's really funny how life works. Hampton Roads' rejection letter said, "Dear Mr. Walsh, thank you for sending us your manuscript. Unfortunately, it does not suit our titles list. It does not match up with our titles list very well, and so it's not the kind of material we ordinarily publish. But we appreciate your sending it to us and wish you well in your publishing endeavors." Well, I knew that was not true. I knew that they never read my manuscript because they could never have said that.
Right.
Because the manuscript was exactly the kinds of books they were publishing.
Yeah.
So that made me angry. And when I got that form letter, and I called the publishing house, and I said, "What's the name of your owner?" And they said, "Bob Friedman." And I said, "Does he read his own mail, or does he get opened by somebody else?" "No, we're a small publishing house. He reads his own mail. Thank you very much." So I took another manuscript, sent it directly to Bob Friedman, not the acquisitions editor, but the guy who owned the place.
Hold that story right there, Neil. We'll be right back with Neil Donald Walsh, New York Times best-selling author. This one, and we'll get into this very soon, What God Wants. Now, this is a compelling answer to all of our biggest questions. We'll be back in a moment.
Get it in writing with the After Dark Newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505. To Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, for those of you who would like to tape shows, here's another possibility for you as well. Downloading complete programs while you sleep, and they're ready for you when you wake up. Podcasting, the Coast to Coast AM Media Center, is going to give you, StreamLink members, free software. I believe that's going to be May 9th, where you'll be able to do that with your own podcasting system. How about that? And just so those of you who don't have StreamLink and you don't want to be left out, well, May 6th, 7th, and 8th, there will be a free StreamLink weekend to give you an opportunity to try this out. And then on Monday the 9th, though, the podcast feature kicks in for StreamLink members right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Neil Donald Walsh. Neil, you were about ready to send a manuscript to the publisher of Hampton Roads.
Well, I sent it with a very angry note inside because the acquisitions editor had rejected my manuscript, telling me that it wasn't suitable for the Hampton Roads titles list. And, of course, it was exactly the kind of books they were publishing. So, but there's a twist here that really it shows you how life works. That letter, that form letter, "Sorry that your book does not suit our titles list," was sent to me in error. It was a mistake.
Oh.
Had the right letter been sent to me, which was an entirely different form letter that indicated that while we have reviewed your material, it doesn't feel that we are prepared to publish it at this time, I would have not had any response at all, never sent it on to the publisher directly. I would have just accepted the form letter, as I did the other four from the other four publishers
mm-hmm.
who sent me this.
But
when I got this one that said, "It doesn't suit our titles list," my mind went, "Wait a minute, you guys didn't even look at this manuscript." I don't mind having it rejected if you looked at it and didn't like it, but to have it rejected without you even opening it up.
Yeah.
So I sent a letter to the, I sent a note to the guy who owned the publishing house. Actually, I just ripped off a piece of yellow legal pad and I put down, "Damn it, read any 10 pages." And stuck it inside and sent it to him. Well, he never got anything like that. There was no covering letter. There was no, "Dear Mr. Friedman, enclosed, please find." There was simply a manuscript with a yellow piece of paper sticking out that said, "Read any 10 pages." So, you know, just because he was so intrigued by it, he literally did that. He flipped the manuscript open and picked out 10 pages at random and read them, picked up the phone and called me.
Just like that.
"We want to publish this book. What is this?" And, of course, it's, I understand, of course, if you read, if you literally do read any 10 pages of Conversations with God, very difficult not to be caught up in it and to be touched deeply by it.
And it takes you to the next 10 and the next 10. You get locked in on that.
Exactly right. So he called and he said he wanted to publish it. And I said, "Yeah, it's interesting because your acquisitions editor turned it down. He couldn't believe it." And I said, "Well, he did." So they and then it came to light that the secretary had sent the wrong note, she reached into the wrong bin for the rejection letter. Although he intended to reject it for other reasons.
Right.
And the fact that I got that letter is what made me go to the next step.
That's amazing.
They published the book immediately. Within 60 days it was out on the streets. They put it to the head of their publications list, and within 5 months it was a bestseller.
And did you ever, Neil, ever in your life expect to be a New York Times bestselling author?
No, I mean, I can't, much less five times.
That's true.
I could never even dream of such a thing. I mean, it's not even something I would have thought about in any way at all. No, the answer to your question is no. But after I saw what was happening here, after the book, you know, was translated into 37 languages and began selling around the world in whatever language it was published in, I realized, oh, I get it. Really, I have nothing to do with this. I'm real clear. This is not about Neil Donald Walsh. This is about the whole process that was never, even from the beginning, intended just for me. It was, in fact, intended for the world entire. And I'm just kind of a bystander here, watching this all happening. And playing the role that I'm playing in the process, which is not a very big role at all, except to take dictation.
Well, what fueled the millions of people who began to read the book and pick up the book? How did that all occur? I mean, did the publishing company, were they the ones who steered this in that direction, or did it just mushroom and it just kept happening over and over?
George, it was a hand-to-hand book. I'm told by the folks in New York that this book, anecdotally, was the biggest hand-to-hand book they had seen in New York in many, many, many years. That is, one person would buy the book and hand it to another and say, "You've got to read this." And they would go out and actually buy multiple copies and say, "You know what? I don't want you to have my copy. I just want you to have this book. You've got to read it." And then that person would get the book and hand it on to somebody else and say, "A friend of mine gave me this." And give it to their brother or their wife or their uncle or whoever the hell, and say, "You got to read this." And ultimately, of course, word of mouth, which is the best sales tool of all, produced 7 or 8 million copies sold. And I think you're right. They tell us in New York, conservatively, that for every book that's been sold, probably 5 people have actually read those books. On the average, each book has been read by at least 2 or 3 other people, everybody in the immediate family, and sometimes outside of that family. So if we're talking 7 or 8 million sold, we're looking at perhaps, 25, 30 million people have read this material.
Yeah, and I believe that's true. Indeed. This latest book, because this has been in the series, of course, of the Conversations with God, the series of books. I mean, you've come up with some pretty provocative questions in this one, what God wants. I mean, all of us, Neil, have gone through our ups and downs in life, and some people have a difficulty finding what you were able to find. Why is that? How come either you found God or God found you, but why do some other people have problems finding that?
George, with your permission, may I just step back for one paragraph and say something that I wanted to add to my last comment?
Right.
Because, you know, as I reflect on what I said, it sounds very much as if I'm boasting or bragging about the number of books that were sold, and I don't want to give that impression. The point that I wanted to make and didn't have a chance to say it all was this. The books have probably been read by 25 or 30 million people. That is not a testimony to me to my writing, to what anything that I may have imagined in my mind that I've accomplished. That's a testimony to people everywhere around the world, in whatever language. It is an announcement that humanity now is ready to look at alternative answers to the oldest questions, that humanity is now losing patience with itself, and that we are reaching out to find another path, another way, saying to each other and to ourselves, there's got to be another way. The way we're living life on this planet, the way we're constructing it, the way we are experiencing it, can't be the way it was meant to be. So I want to make it real clear that the point I was trying to make is those numbers indicate nothing more than humanity's readiness now. We are on the cusp. We're at a place called ready, and that's what those numbers show.
You know, it's kind of interesting to me. I got an email from someone who's, and by the way, I've gotten thousands from people tonight who are just excited about this. But I got one from one individual who said, are we going to talk about religion again? And I sent him back a message and said, no, you just don't understand, do you? Listen to the show. And then you send me another email, and hopefully that person will do that. I mean, there's such a big difference between religion and God, and a lot of people need to understand that, Neil.
Well, that's exactly right. That is the single message that God is, I believe, seeking to bring now to the world. Matt Lauer on the Today Show on NBC a while back asked me at the end of an interview, and all the good questions always come in the last 30 seconds, he said, Neil, if God had one message to bring to the world and could say only one thing, and he had 30 seconds left on this telecast to say it, what would God's message to the world be? And I said, you know, Matt, I can give it to you in 5 words. You've got me all wrong.
So true. So
now,
true.
If those words are true, and if those words are actually God's words to the world, it opens up the question once again. Questions that we have been afraid to address, questions that we have been loath to ask, questions that we have been told directly not to ask, questions that we have been told if we ask them, it's blasphemy even to ask the question, much less consider an alternate answer. See, the problem is that humanity has had the arrogance, this, by the way, addresses the question that I interrupted you for. You asked me, how is it possible, or why does it work this way, that somehow or another I've been able to hear these answers and other people haven't. We have been trained. We have been absolutely culturalized against and trained away from any thought that God, divinity, higher powers, greater wisdom, deity would speak directly to us, much less through us. We've been told, in fact, that not only does this not happen, to say that it's happening is a sin. It is the sin of blasphemy. It is apostasy. And in some places of the world, right now, today, not in medieval times, but in this day and age, a person could be killed for saying what I'm saying, that God is speaking to me and through me. And in fact, people have been killed in recent times for such testimony. So with that kind of bias against, an extreme bias throughout all of humanity, by the way, throughout all of the world's great religions, the world's great religions don't agree on much. There's great disagreement between the big three religions and some of the small ones as well. But there's one thing that all religions seem to want to agree on. God does not speak to humanity directly, but only through us, only through this religion, only through our prophet, only through our savior, only through our figurehead, only through the person that began this religion. So you must come to us and you must come through us, and don't even begin to think that God would speak directly to you. So why is it that I'm able to hear these messages and others are not? I think because most people are scared to death to even imagine that the God of this universe would speak directly to them. And that's the saddest thing of all, because God's been doing nothing from the beginning of time but talking directly to and communicating directly with humanity.
And then you get some people, Neil, who would say to you, Neil, there is no God. What would you tell them?
I would say, you know, I would agree with you. I mean, if you think of God, if you are saying there is no God in the form of another being or some exterior essence or element in the universe that stands apart from us and dictates and controls human affairs and all the other ways in which we imagine God to be, then I would say to that person, you're absolutely right. You are fundamentally correct. But then I would say to that person, would you be willing to consider exchanging the word God for the word life? Supposing that God and life were interchangeable words, and and that what God is, life is, and that what life is, that God is, and supposing that life was the physical manifestation of the thing that I call God, could you go there? And 98% of those people would say, well, yeah, by that definition, yeah, I can go there.
They think you're trying to trick them with something.
Then we're opening, however, to a whole new discussion. And the idea of being tricked goes away. As long as they're willing to at least talk about it, they begin to see that, wait a minute, this guy's onto something here. And we begin to see then that life is a force, an energy in the universe, a primal energy that can take any form it wishes to take and that we can use, and we can use with consistent and predictable results to produce the outcomes that we would select. In fact, we're doing so right now on the Earth. The only difference is, and the only problem is, that we're doing it unconsciously, and that's why the world is turning out the way it is.
Have you ever yet been able to answer that question, why is it? Why do we have this life force, this God? What's its whole purpose?
It's purposeless. It is what is. It is. That's like saying, what is the purpose of life, that is, of the energy of life? It does not have an intention or a purpose other than to express itself through physicality, that it might know itself in that form. But there's no other specific intention or purpose except to simply, life seeks to experience more life through the process of life itself. God, then, if we interchange the words, seeks to express more God through the process of God itself. That's why even religions say, interestingly enough, we are made in the image and likeness of God.
Right.
And in this, religions have it profoundly correct.
You know, I have battered my head against the wall for so many years, Neil, trying to figure out some of these questions we're going to talk about tonight. I am convinced that there is some kind of order in the universe. I'm convinced that it was created by a higher power, whatever it may be. I, like you, don't believe in a man sitting on a cloud like they taught me when I was a kid in catechism class years ago. But there's something out there. What is very difficult for me to understand is how, I guess. You know, when you think about the universe and how scientists and physicists say it was formed through a big bang, which I still question, by the way, I'm at wit's end trying to figure out if there was this supreme creator that helps steer us in this direction that we're all going. How did it come about? I mean, how did it form? And I just can't answer it, and it frustrates the heck out of me.
Well, don't feel bad. It frustrated Albert Einstein, and he had a mind twice as big as yours and mine combined. Now, he spent the last 20 years of his life trying to find the answer to that question. How many angels fit on the head of a pin? I want to suggest to you, with honor and with delicacy, that perhaps the inquiry is pointless. The issue isn't really how did it all start, or who began it all, or what was the beginning process. The issue really is, what's going on now? What is our right relationship to what's going on now? Who and what really is God? What is our right relationship to that? And most profoundly important, what is our right relationship to each other? And in what way can we use the energies that we call life to produce and create the life of which we have dreamed, and to give our children and our children's children and their children as well a future and not an end? Those are the key questions. So we can sit here and discuss philosophically how it all began, but I'd rather look at how it all is going to end if we're not careful, because the end of life as we know it is just around the corner.
Well, and that's very possible too. And I tell you what, it is less frustrating having to think the other way. Quite honestly, I mean, if I continue batting my head against the wall for this, I'm not going to go anywhere with it, as you just said with Einstein, and he never found the answer.
No,
and I probably won't.
And it's almost pointless. However, here's what's interesting: when we find the answer to the latter questions, what about tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow? When we begin to look at the questions that I have asked, suddenly we begin to get glimpses of the answers to the first questions. Because the answer ultimately is circular. But the real inquiry now is, how can we head off? You know, if George, I don't want to be an alarmist here, but I'm not the first person on your program, I'm sure, to say to you that if we continue in the direction in which we're going, and we may not, something could turn us around, and I'm working for that. But if we continue in the direction we're going, I don't think we have 50 years left. Not. I mean, the Earth isn't going to implode. Life will not disappear from the face of the Earth, but life as we know it will not be experienced by our children and our children's children. So, and we can turn that all around, and we can do it really in the blink of an eye. In 5 or 10 years, we can make everything less than that. We can make everything so much better, and our lives will be the lives of which we have dreamed. But we must get a grip here and see what we're doing to ourselves and use the power of God and the energy of life to resource our experience and make it other than what it now is.
There seems to be too much greed, too much evil combating exactly what you've said, which I believe we need to do. How do you combat that? How do you fight off the power-hungry people who, I think, in some cases on this planet, may just be pure evil in their own way because they have their own agenda? How do we fight that?
Beliefs. The answer is this. We have been approaching the problem that humanity has created for itself for the past several hundred years, indeed perhaps for several thousand years, at every level except the level at which the problem exists. We've been approaching the problems of humanity as if they were, for instance, political problems, and politics does not solve them. Sometimes it puts a mandate on them, but the same problem comes back around to bite us before too long, and politics does not work. We've been trying to use economics to solve the problems of humanity, imagining that if we throw enough money at it or withhold enough money from it in the form of sanctions and so forth, that we can solve the problem, and we have found ourselves impotent in the face of that as well. Then when politics don't work, and when economics don't work, then we decide, okay, it's a military problem. That's it, of course. We should have known from the beginning. So we'll use military means by which to solve the problem, but that, of course, doesn't work either. Because the problem is not a political problem, nor is it an economic problem, nor is it a military problem. The problem facing humanity today is a spiritual problem.
You know, Neil, I wish we could get every leader of every country, throw them into a room with you, and have you say, read this, and then we're going to talk about this when we're done. You might be able to solve most of these ills.
Well, I think that God speaking through us will. I believe it's going to happen, by the way. I don't think pessimistically about the future. But you asked what would solve the problem. Changing our most fundamental beliefs, because beliefs is just a small word for spirituality. The problem is spiritual, that is, the problem has to do with what we fundamentally believe about life and about each other. And when we shift and change those beliefs, the first domino will fall and every other one will follow. So the answer is to embark on a worldwide, a global effort to change the most fundamental beliefs of humanity about God, about life, and about each other. That's the work that I'm doing.
When we come back, Neil, at the top of the hour, you write in your book, be careful, this book is dangerous, what God wants. Tell me why. We'll be back in a moment.
Want a time travel? Go back to past shows on StreamLink. Sign up online at coasttocoastam.com.